Welcome to the Cycling Podcast coverage of the 2025 Vuelta a España, proudly supported by Lloyds. This is the 10th consecutive year that we've covered the Vuelta a España with daily episodes recorded on the ground at the Spanish Grand Tour. But it's the first time we've been in a position to produce daily episodes of the Lloyds Tour of Britain Men, the national tour, of course, and that is thanks to sponsorship from Lloyds. Lloyds is now well into the second year of a multi-year sponsorship deal to support bike racing across Britain through its partnership with British Cycling. That's on the road and track as well as mountain biking and BMX. Title sponsorship of the Lloyds Tour of Britain races for both men and women, which are the country's flagship stage races, is at the top of a pyramid that extends right down to grassroots level. Lloyds also sponsors the Great Britain cycling team as they make their way towards the 2028 Olympics, as well as the national championships and national series races across a range of disciplines. Tune in to our second stage coverage of the Lloyds Tour of Britain on Thursday morning, but before all that, it's time to join Daniel over in Spain.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, celebrating 10 years of the Cycling Podcast on the ground every day at the Grand Tours.
Larry Wobas, Arratsaldeon, which I believe means good evening in Basque.
Good evening.
I believe. Good evening. Good evening, Larry. Well, it's up to us. It falls to us to bring the entertainment today because it was one of those stages, and we've had them before, which the history books will record, didn't really happen. Sort of happened. The general classification of the Vuelta a España tonight will reflect the fact that at a stage, some bike riding did occur today, but there will be, the annals will record, no stage winner here in Bilbao of the 11th stage of the Vuelta a España. Why? Because, well, we thought that pro-Palestine protests would possibly affect the stage today, and so it proved to be, because due to the volume of pro-Palestine protesters at the finish line, particularly on the finishing straight, the last 400 metres, the decision was taken mid-race with about 15 kilometres to go in the race to curtail events or to move the finish line, which sort of became a bit of a virtual finish line, to 3 kilometres from the original finish line. GC times were taken there, but there was no stage winner. And the riders knew this, in spite of the fact that one of those riders, the guy who probably would have been the stage winner, Tom Pidcock, did carry on riding through to the original finish line while the rest of the peloton sort of swerved left towards the San Mamés Stadium, which is the home of Athletic Club de Bilbao. And Larry, I'm going to turn my computer around to show you that that's where I am. Yeah,
that's
I'm sitting in the stadium because that's where the press room was today. So, Larry, we've described the Vuelta so far as a little bit uneventful. Today was certainly eventful. A lot to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say it was eventful, I think, for what happened on and off the bike, actually.
Yes, it certainly was, Larry. Well, I'm going to tell you, first of all, a little bit about this morning. The stage was starting outside the San Mamés Stadium, where I am currently talking to you this evening. And, well, on the way to the start, Larry, we'd heard that some things could get a bit feisty today. I think I talked yesterday, or we have talked about how the Basque sort of separatist movement historically has felt a lot of empathy with the pro-Palestine movement, sort of separatist movements, independence movements, you could say. You can quibble about the terminology, but certainly it is a fact that this is an issue that is keenly sort of supported in this part of the country. Left-wing political parties, EH Bildu and Podemos, had made their support known, well, certainly in the last few days, for protests taking place at the Vuelta a España. There were other pressure groups, support groups for the pro-Palestine movement, who have even had press conferences in the last few days encouraging people to go out on the on the race course today and protest peacefully. But we wondered what kind of stage we would get. There was reports that the Basque police were not confident that they could guarantee the safety of the peloton. So this morning, the Israel bus was parked normally. Among Israel Premier Tech bus was parked normally with all the other buses this morning. Larry, I also noticed that there actually weren't as many Palestinian flags as there have been in recent days close to the start. That seemed a little bit unusual. Then, Larry, as you can imagine, I was having sort of quite a few off-the-record conversations this morning with riders about what they had heard, about what was in store for them. I was informed, Larry, and I don't know, maybe you were party, you're privy to some of this, but there was some sort of, there is a CPA WhatsApp group, but from the way it was described to me today, it sounds a little bit ad hoc. It doesn't seem to be terribly well organized. It's not simply a case of just the one representative for every team being able to contribute. It seemed like a little bit of a free-for-all. Anyway, some sort of conversation, some sort of informal referendum took place last night, whereby I was told the majority of the team's representatives expressed their support for Israel pulling out, more or less forcefully. They were either sort of telling their Israel counterparts that they needed to pull out, or they were saying, we would prefer that. I was then told, Larry, well, maybe you would like to comment on that. First of all, this WhatsApp group, you know of its existence.
Yeah, sure. So there is like this CPA WhatsApp group, and, you know, I've been in it before at like some of the Grand Tours. So for every race, there's like a CPA WhatsApp group. But in the end, it's a lot of faffing around for the majority of it. So like a lot of it is like, you know, just this little nitpicky stuff about stages. And to be honest, personally, being in it with all that stuff stresses me out because, like, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like being ignorant of whatever is about to come sometimes is just easier because sometimes they stress a lot for not a whole lot. But then the one few times that I've joined it are like the few times there have been these, like, you know, catastrophic weather days, like in the Giro and stuff. So, you know, like in 2020, the day that we, you know, moved the start, or, you know, in the Livigno day. Anyway, you know, that was last year. So on those crisis days, that's when all of a sudden the group just like lights up. So all these people join who are not necessarily the CPA delegate, but other people want to get involved. A lot of times teams have a CPA delegate in this group who doesn't even really care, but maybe if there's like the head of the group is Italian, it'll be an Italian rider from your team that joins, or, you know, things like that. So, Larry, yeah, I've been in a few times.
I'll just stop you there. For the record, you are not privy to the WhatsApp group for the Vuelta. It's only riders who are in the Vuelta.
No. It'd only be you guys who are in the Vuelta.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So each team has a delegate that's chosen at the beginning of the race. So, you know, each team at the Vuelta would have a delegate in this group. But then when a day is like, there's rumblings of potential chaos, whether that's weather or like today for these protests, a lot more people join the group. And then a lot of people, you know, have an opinion. So that's where it gets a lot more interesting, I would say. So, yeah, for sure that I guess there was a lot of talk in the group.
And in addition to that, Larry, if I'm not mistaken, there are five CPA representatives. So beyond the team representatives, there are five overall representatives for the CPA on a Grand Tour, I believe, who have a different. Mark Soler is one of them here. Sean Quinn is another. Anyway, that's maybe getting into too much detail. But I then asked around, okay, so these conversations were going on last night. There was a clear preference on the majority held a clear preference for Israel to pull out. What was the resolution? What is going to happen about this? I was told there'd be a meeting at the start. This was with about 12 minutes, maybe 8 minutes to go to the start. And the obvious question then became, well, when the hell is this meeting going to happen? I was told it's going to happen in a minute. Then made my way down to the start line, which was where I imagined it would probably take place. And there was, I mean, I posted a picture on Twitter. There was, I suppose, a scrum of around 20 riders. Certainly, it wasn't strictly one per team. I think there were multiple from a couple of teams, but I'm not entirely sure. And Kiko García, who's the technical director of the Vuelta a España, was in there, as well as, I think, the chief commissaire here at the Vuelta a España. It was mainly Elia Viviani who was talking, but also Marc Soler was talking, Sean Quinn was talking, Simone Petilli, of course, the Intermarché rider who was hit by one of the protesters or collided with one of the protesters yesterday. He was talking as well, but it was very, very short. Then the riders dispersed and made their way to the start line. As they dispersed, I was able to speak to Elia Viviani. This is what he told me.
No, sì, no, certo, certo, era chiaro. No, no, non si è deciso, era solo una conversazione tra noi e la...
Nothing was decided, it was just a conversation between us and the organisation. We, the riders, have seen in the last week that the organisation is going above and beyond to keep us safe. Lots of police, lots of security measures. Obviously, if there's a situation that's dangerous for the group, something must be decided. As the organisation says, we don't know what awaits us. Let's see what kind of protests there are. In the end, if everything is peaceful, there's no problem at all, so the race will go on as normal. If it's a peaceful protest that stops the race, we'll restart. If it's something that creates the risk of crashes, we'll decide how to proceed with the jury. It's not about excluding Israel, not at all. This has never been on the agenda because we're not going to go against our colleagues, never, not at all.
Da parte dei corridori non è mai esistita questa cosa perché non siamo dell'opinione di andare contro dei nostri colleghi al 100%.
So Larry, Viviani essentially saying that they were going to race and see what happened and reassess if the worst or something which obstructed the race did come to pass. Just going to give you a sense generally of other riders and what they were feeling about these rumours of protests and obstruction to the race today. I did speak to a few of them. We'll just play one of those interviews. It was with Ben O'Connor, and here was what his, well, thoughts were before today's stage.
Yeah, there's certainly chats about it. From a more selfish point of view, just kind of thinking about my rib, so I haven't really paid as much attention to the chatter about it. But yeah, it was pretty prolific yesterday, and it was pretty dangerous when people were running out in front of the road. You know, I don't think people are aware that it's pretty easy just to fall at slow speeds and break a bone. That can completely derail someone's can derail someone's career, can derail their goals and aspirations and hard work, just all by an act of selfishness. So yeah, it's one of those ones where it's really a bit of a shame because you want to be racing here La Volta a España and seeing the kind of the pride and of the region, of each region, rather than kind of being caught up in what feels like a continuous protest.
And just lastly, so this was conversations in the peloton with other riders, or was it sort of WhatsApp groups overnight as well, riders groups?
Yeah, there's certain groups, but yeah, it's kind of, it's one of those situations where it shouldn't really be falling upon the riders. It should be the governing body that should be making a move, a clearer call with the police and race organizer, and I don't know. Sometimes it's always like no one really wants to take the blame if nothing really happens. We'll find out on the road today though.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, Larry, so that sets the scene, I suppose. At this point, I suggest we recap what actually happened in today's, well, rather sort of frivolously named, it wasn't a frivolous kind of stage, but frivolously named, Jamonómetro.
El Jamonómetro, de Michele Pelacci.
So, Larry, how many hams today?
And we'll give it a four.
Four. Okay, you're basing that strictly on the action that we saw.
Yeah. Oh, you think it's five because there's just so much action all over the place, or what?
Well, for the recycling, yes, possibly four. But given that we didn't have a stage winner, it feels like it needs to be sort of either kind of synthetic, not real ham. The kind of ham. I don't know if you've ever heard of this scandal. Remember the team that Eddie Merckx.
Well, maybe there were just no hams awarded. There were four on the line and no one got a ham. Maybe.
There you go. have you ever heard, Larry, the story about Eddie Merckx's old team Molteni? Molteni were. They made sort of processed meats, and they were involved in this huge scandal of like fake mortadella, which was sort of a typical cycling story. But anyway, okay, so four or zero, you pick your sort of poison there. The stage itself, Bilbao to Bilbao, 157 kilometers. There were to be five Cat 3 climbs, two Cat 2 climbs. Poor Ursula and Rasmus De Bruyne of Alpecin did not start. Mentioned Ben O'Connor. We heard from Ben O'Connor. He told me also this morning that he had a rib injury yesterday. There was a crash that we didn't see on the TV involving also Matteo Jorgensen. Ben O'Connor also came down yesterday. He had rib problems. He'd gone for an X-ray, and that ruled out broken ribs, but he wasn't. He was a bit suspicious. He thought there was something that might be amiss, and he said he didn't expect to have a good day. And sure enough, he was dropped early on. We had Santiago Buitrago trying to get away. He was one of the early attackers. But finally, with 134 kilometers to go, Mads Pedersen accelerated, eventually dragged two other riders with him, Marc Soler and Luis Aular of Movistar. Soler was only 3 minutes and 30 seconds down on GC. They stayed together with Visma pulling for a long time, until about 80 kilometers to go, when Soler attacked at the bottom of the Alto de Morga. Just as the peloton were closing in effectively, Pedersen and Aular were duly caught, while Soler took his gap to over a minute. At 59 kilometers to go on the run into the Vivero, this is the first time up the Vivero, Soler was caught. There was a big fight into the bottom of the Vivero with Ineos and Visma, particularly pulling. Landismo was alive or revived. He attacked 3 kilometers from the top of the Vivero with 54 kilometers to go. Santiago Buitrago of Bahrain Victorious, he went next, countered behind Landa, and the two of them, those two, soon joined forces. Though Landa was the first over the Vivero. There was a counter-attack behind them with Eddie Dunbar, Campenaerts, Bonu, Rouland and Hamilton. And then Mads Pedersen, well, he was also resuscitated, revived, brought back from the dead, and he joined that group as well. And in fact, well, at a certain point was going through that group. We then had the second ascent of the Vivero. I said Landismo was revived. Well, it didn't last very long, because he was soon capitulating, blowing up, exploding. I'm not sure, well, I didn't speak to him at the finish, had other things to take care of, but I don't know if there was an injury. I don't think there was any kind of mechanical. I think he just blew up.
He looked like he was cramping.
Okay.
He was like holding his leg and trying to stretch it out.
Okay. So, Larry, the next climb was to be the Alto de Pique. And on the way into the Alto de Pique, for the first time in the day, pretty much, or since very early on, we had no one down the road. We were set to have, poised to have a big GC battle. At around this time, Larry, I was walking down the finish line in central Bilbao, and well, we'd seen already, because the peloton had gone through the finish line once already, we'd seen the size and the volume of the protest. And in fact, the first time the peloton did go through, there were protesters sort of pressing on the barriers, and the barriers kind of encroached into the road. When I went when I walked to the finish line, there was a long 200 meter long line of police and very heavily protected, heavily armed police in some cases. And the crowds were, or the protesters, it was solely protesters really for the last 300, 400 meters. I would say 7 or 8 deep. I don't know how many in total protesters there were, but easily in the hundreds, I would say a couple of thousand. Anyway, due to the number and the volume and the, I suppose, I don't know whether aggression's the right word, but the security threat, decision was then taken that the finish line would be moved effectively to 3 kilometers to go. I think the peloton or the team cars heard this when there was about 15 kilometers to go in the race, just before the Alto de Pique. Larry, I'm now going to pass over to you because at this point I was busy running back from what had been the finish line to the team buses, mindful that that was where the riders were going to end up. So what happened, Larry, on the last time up the Alto de Pique?
So yeah, I know yesterday, we spoke about what could happen. You know, will Almeida attack? What does he need to do? Blah blah blah. And in the end, yeah, I was like, oh, positioning is going to be important, but the race had been so hard up to that point that the group wasn't enormous. You know, maybe it was 20 something guys going into the bottom, maybe a little bigger, but yeah, it was action. So I don't remember if it was on that climb or the climb before that Almeida did make an acceleration, but then essentially he was overtaken. And yeah, then what we really saw was Tom Pidcock come to the fore, and he put in an insane acceleration and showed that on a climb like that, actually, he was the strongest. So, you know, I know a few weeks ago on a similar sort of climb, we saw him insanely strong in the Arctic race. But, you know, the Vuelta is an entirely new level and a different, totally different type of racing. And yeah, I guess he's really shown that he's ready for this Vuelta. And, you know, I think the climbs like that, they suit him well, you know, short, punchy climbs. And he even distanced Vingegaard, which was insane, you know. So Vingegaard sort of was like yo-yoing from his wheel. And over the top, he did gap him. But Vingegaard came back on the descent. We saw a little bit of, yeah, the group behind blow. It kind of separated. But then it pretty much came back together. And there were maybe like 6-7 guys in the back with Matteo Jorgensen, Almeida, Felix Gall, and a few others. But I know, yeah, maybe over the top there was like a group of 3 behind with Felix Gall, and I couldn't see the other 2, maybe Almeida and someone. But yeah, to be honest, as I was watching, the commentators didn't explain that the race would be over with 3K to go. And all of a sudden I just saw the red car slowing down and waving the guys to stop. And so, yeah, I was not exactly, I didn't totally understand what was happening. Yeah, then it obviously became pretty clear to me pretty quick what the situation was. So, yeah, and then it's a bit of a shame for Tom Pidcock, as it did look like he probably would have won that stage, and it would have been great for his team as well. But, yeah, I mean, it's
bigger
things.
As I said, Larry, Pidcock was the only rider, as far as I'm aware, who did carry on towards the original finish line. We didn't know why. We didn't know whether he'd not been told or whether he'd simply made a mistake and his GPS wasn't working. I don't know. But we were intrigued to find out why that was. So we're going to hear from Tom Pidcock in just a second. He did eventually make it back to the Q36.5 bus outside the San Mamés Stadium. He was disappointed at first, obviously. Pretty angry, it seemed, at first. He went straight onto the bus without even Larry kissing his dogs, who were waiting there at the finish.
Oh, wow.
Shockingly.
That's
His dogs were in a pram waiting for him at the finish line. At the bus. And he went straight onto the bus. And then emerged onto his time trial bike on the rollers, did a warm down, and then he spoke to us. We're going to hear that interview in just a second. I should also just say it was a strange mood. It was a strange mood all day, but outside the Q36.5 bus in particular, there was sort of mixed feelings. We had the team kind of boss or owner there, Ivan Glazenberg, South African billionaire. He was visiting the Vuelta today, and I overheard, at the risk of speaking out of school, I overheard him sort of exclaim, Vingegaard's going to be something-ing himself now, suggesting that Vingegaard would be scared now. You can probably fill in the gaps, but he was certainly very happy. Anyway, Larry, We would ordinarily, at this point in the Hamonometro, tell you what the results were and what the general classification now looks like. I can tell you that the next brewing fiasco is what exactly are the times on general classification, because we don't have them yet, and it's currently, well, it's way after the time in the evening when we've usually got them. We've got no official communique yet from the Vuelta a España organization with the results on them, so I'm not going to give any results. You're going to have to just guess where everyone is on general classification, bearing in mind that Tom Pidcock has gained some time tonight. Maybe by the end of the episode, we'll be able to give
10 seconds.
Yeah. Maybe by the end of the episode, we will be able to give you the general classification. Anyway, Larry, we are going to hear from Tom Pidcock first, and then we are going to hear from the Vuelta technical director, Kiko García, who I and several other journalists spoke to. We sort of cornered him around the team buses after the finish, and well, you're going to hear him first responding to the suggestion that the CPA, whether officially or unofficially, or people at the CPA, wanted Israel Premier Tech to pull out of the Vuelta a España. So here they are, Tom Pidcock and Kiko García.
It's hard to describe the disappointment, to be honest. I mean, I felt like today was my day. I feel like, yeah, there should be always a finish line. We're not riding a Sportif, are we? So, yeah.
When did you hear about the news? And it sounded like you decided to go on towards the finish line, so you saw those protesters there as well.
Well, it's just doing a Tom Pidcock thing, innit? But, no, I knew the finish line was at 3K, but I actually didn't know when 3K was. I was too busy trying to, you know, rotate with Rionis. And, yeah, when we passed through there, kind of realised that there wasn't going to be a winner, and, yeah. Yeah, anyway. I think, it's not easy. I think Vuelta did what they could, the organisation, to keep us safe. I think, you know, I don't want to say anything political, I'm going to get in trouble. I mean, I think a lot of people have, you know, held back from talking about it publicly, but it is a bit scary sometimes in the peloton. But, yeah, I think as long as our safety is first, then, you know, we can continue racing, and that's what we're here to do. I think bike racing's got nothing to do with what's happening on the other. Yeah.
Were you scared when you had to raise the banner to go through?
No, not really. I think, at that point we were racing, so, yeah.
I mean, anything, what will you keep with you about this day?
Well, I think a lot of people talk about what's on paper, you know, and now I don't have I'm not saying I would have won, but I had a good chance to win, and it's a disappointment, but not wasting any energy on it. We've got a long way to go.
Sure about that?
Because I was
from
told.
Us, I didn't receive any communique from the AGCP or CPA going on that direction. If they all together and we support them, for sure, if we are all together on it, it's going to be easier. But until now, I didn't see any communique from anyone. You know, life is a balance. So today's stage was a balance. It was probably one of the most beautiful stages in the Vuelta. Probably the most cycling feeling region of the Vuelta. But at the same time, we knew that it was also, the region of these protests. And we understood that it was a very difficult day. I already repeated for 10 times, probably this evening. We cannot do anything. We just follow the regulations. We just follow the rules. It's an obligation for us to have Team Israel riding. And if we don't accept them, probably we have a lot of demands coming against us. So, until now, we just try to protect first the Team Israel. We put special protection for them, special convoys, you know, all kind of protections for the riders. From a couple of days ago, we also tried to protect the other teams and, everybody around the race. But now, I really believe that it's time to take a decision. And not from us, but from all the families, all the stakeholders implicated, because it's time for safety first. And honestly, we have no time to lose. It's time right now.
Pico, that was today. Is anything planned for this evening? Any more meetings? Or what do you think is going to happen in the next few hours?
Yes, I had no time to check, and I need to sit with my director, with Javier, and see what we can do. But for sure, we will have plenty of meetings, yes.
There were discussions that maybe Team Israel should pull out of the race. Did those suggestions also arrive to you? Are you discussing it?
Sorry, but who suggested?
No, that were some teams in the CPA talks.
Well, Larry, a day that will be completely overshadowed by politics. We heard Tom Pidcock say there that it was a shame that... I'm paraphrasing here, but he sort of said that it's a shame that politics was encroaching on the race and it sort of ruined today's stage. I can understand his frustration, but as we've said many times, you can't keep politics out of professional cycling when you've got teams like Israel Premier Tech, whose owner, Sylvain Adams, is the self-styled sort of number one unofficial ambassador for Israel in the world, and he has called his team Israel Premier Tech. Incidentally, Sylvain Adams was in the Israel Premier Tech team car today, and I believe that there were individuals in the team, not sure who exactly, they were very keen for him to be in the team car today, for him to see what has been happening at the Vuelta a España, the size of the protests, what the riders have been facing, and of course today was the most vociferous and the biggest protest they have seen yet. We believe that Sylvain Adams may speak to the media. He may speak to us tomorrow morning. But Larry, you have very much a rider's eye on this. And I'm sure you know riders at Israel. I spoke to a couple off the record today. Unfortunately, I was caught on camera, I believe, talking to one of the riders at the start this morning. So when I say Israel, when I sort of suggest that I've heard things from Israel Premier Tech riders, I'll ask, listen, don't assume that it was that conversation this morning that you saw me having with Jake Stewart, because I don't want the finger to be pointed directly at him. We talked to a lot of riders, Larry, as you know. Anyway, Larry, I'm sure you feel slightly sympathetic with them, with purely their plight as riders this evening.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's tough because also a lot of these riders signed for that team before this all started to happen, you know. So, a lot of those guys, they've been there for a few years. And while, yes, maybe choosing to sign for a team like Israel Premier Tech at the time also could have still seen, you know, as like a political move, I don't think it was at least in the forefront of the media and everything, and there had not been this war that, you know, had developed yet. So, you know, I think it's challenging because just because guys ride for a certain team doesn't mean they support the choices of, you know, that country or its government, you know? I mean, it's the same. I don't know. I saw his stand-up. He came to Monaco, and he did this piece on Russia. Well, you know, essentially just where people are from, and someone in the audience was from Russia, and they were really, you know, because he asked people in the audience, oh, where are you from? And then they were really reluctant to say that they were from Russia, and then he said, oh, you know, I don't understand why everyone's so scared. Just because you're from a place doesn't mean you agree with that place's politics. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you agree with what your country's doing. And so, I mean, while it's a little bit different because you are sort of wearing almost the flag of the country and representing them in international competition, I think a lot of these guys don't necessarily support what's going on, and they are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they're trying to ride their bike and do their job. And I would say most of them probably aren't very politically involved as well. But, you know, that's the situation that we're in. Yeah. And I mean, it's just, I think it's hard. Yeah, they're just trying to do their jobs, I think. But
yeah. I mean, I said again, we're not going to get too much into the right. We're not going to get too much into the wrongs and rights this evening, Larry. But what I did emphasize the other day after the team time trial was that the most important thing here is education. And the protest today, well, they will feel that they have succeeded because they disrupted the Vuelta a España. They also succeeded in, as far as we're aware, this evening doing it peacefully. I don't think anyone was hurt, and it's certainly good news tonight that no riders were hurt, because that was what we all feared. But they succeeded in disrupting the Vuelta a España. I think more broadly, they will have succeeded in making us all, or encouraging us all, to form our own opinions and educate ourselves. And, you know, as I said the other day, that would be my advice to the riders. That's my advice to myself. Riders who might have mindlessly signed contracts with Israel over the last couple of years without really wanting to think about it, then the best thing that they could have done then and could still do would be to be as well informed as they can. Even if it's just spending 20 minutes a day over the next few weeks reading news articles, they might still get it completely wrong, but at least that's better than having no information and no education about the issue. You mentioned Russia. Obviously, internationally, as far as world sport is concerned, there's been a disparity between the treatment of Russia and the treatment of Israel. Again, not going to debate whether that's right or wrong, but just to say that when the cause for the UCI to intervene, I think they should intervene, and there should certainly be a statement from them tonight, because the riders are in above their head. It's a ridiculous situation that, you know, riders are having meetings 10 minutes before the start of a Vuelta a España stage, essentially trying to decide the fate of this competition, and, you know, having to put their head above the parapet. They shouldn't have to do it. But those waiting for the UCI to intervene, historically, the UCI and sporting federations generally have always taken their lead from the IOC. That's the International Olympic Committee, because they're all sort of beholden to the IOC. And the IOC's position at the moment on the Israel-Palestine conflict is that they are giving the two nations equal treatment, in that Palestine was represented at the last Olympics, and I think they've been represented at all Olympics since 1996, and so were Israel. And that's all they're saying. They were challenged on this a few days ago by an Australian channel, SBS, and they reiterated this, that is as far as they're going to go at the moment. But so opposition pressure is ramping up in the international sporting community. The Norwegian FA, I think, the other day called on FIFA to impose sanctions on Israel. Of course, I think we've already made this distinction in previous episodes. Israel Premier Tech is not the Israeli national team. It's always been a little bit ambiguous whether they are or aren't, or how much funding they're receiving from the Israeli government. Sylvain Adams has said in the past that it's a negligible amount. I think that more recently he said that they're not receiving anything, but it's more complicated than that, because, as I said, he represents the nation. He is unashamedly an ambassador of the... He sells himself, he puts himself forward as that. And, you know, there are various other ways in which he might benefit from, and the team as well, might benefit from a cozy relationship with the Israeli government. So it's not all about money. So, yeah, important to set those things out. I think what happens now, Larry, we heard Kiko García, I think, say that today was the day that the World Organization feared the most. Bilbao, its history of, as I said before, empathy with the Palestine cause. So it may be that things calm down, but, you know, I have spoken to Israel riders over the last Israel Premier Tech riders over the last few days, and it's been pretty nasty for them, I think, in the peloton. It must have been nasty every day seeing the protests and hearing the chants and knowing that they were being singled out by people who at the side of the road who won't necessarily... They might assume that all of the riders representing Israel Premier Tech sympathize with the Israel position in the conflict. They probably don't know.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I feel bad for the riders, because, I mean, I can't imagine I can't imagine that the other riders in the peloton, you know, you were saying that they were being, you know, saying that they need to drop out, whatever. To be honest, in any race that I've been in, I have not seen that, you know. I think most riders sympathize with the riders on the team that they didn't necessarily choose to be in this situation, you know. And it's not so easy for everyone to just say, you know, places in cycling are hard to come by, you know, jobs, whatever. And, you know, it's not like there are that many guys that could just say, you know what, I'm done here. I don't want to ride for this team. I don't support this cause, you know, and then change, you know, like it's not that easy to just get out of a contract, or find a new team, especially mid season. So, you know, I think that's the challenging thing. But what I do hope will come of this is that the UCI will take a stance and do something, because, you know, maybe that will be the good thing to come of these protests, is that the UCI realized that they can't just sit back and sit on their hands and just wait, you know, because, you know, it isn't up to the riders. You know, I mean, yeah, the riders can try or, you know, make an effort, but it's up to the UCI to take a stance and make a call on this. And
it's
not easy.
Yeah, and what they could do, the first thing, they could start with a statement. They could start with a statement and also a presence. David Lapartien, as far as I know, was not here today. You often see him on other occasions when there aren't issues as complicated and as pressing as this to be resolved, but the UCI should be here represented. This is a big issue facing the sport at the moment, and it's an issue that the sport will face in the future. I mean, Larry, this morning on the silly little video that I do on Strava, I was talking about the CAS team. KAS, the big Basque team of the 70s. And it just occurred to me today, you know, they were a soft drinks company in Vitoria-Gasteiz. And I was talking a bit about how that team came together. And it's contrast with Israel Premier Tech and contrast with a lot of the sponsors currently in the sport. And, you know, we've got some heat as well, and probably justifiably so, for focusing on Israel, and there are other teams here whose sponsors are, well, who certainly are supported by kind of nation states, and they deserve scrutiny as well. But unfortunately, and this is where I sort of indirectly, Larry, point the finger a little bit at, not so much at the riders, but in a lot of cases at the agents as well, that there has been wage escalation in professional cycling. And professional cycling, but this also applies to professional sport at large, it's made its bed with this kind of sponsor in a lot of cases. And, you know, in the sort of scramble to earn more money and have more resources, look, the sport has benefited. I mean, I talked about Nia Pros demanding to go to wind tunnels and demanding, you know, tens of thousands invested in them. And it is made possible by billionaires, nation states, and so on and so forth. And that's a big contrast with what this sport used to be. Soft drinks manufacturers. I mean, I don't think there were, you know, you used to get tens of thousands of people protesting about, I don't know, the sort of Fanta lookalike.
Wrong flavor.
Yeah. Or, I mean, you're lucky, Larry, because you currently represent a watchmaker. I don't know. Maybe I'll spend the next few hours digging into the ethical, probity of Tudor watches. I don't know if they've got any skeletons in their closets. I suspect not. But anyway, Larry, so that is the only place where I would say, look, again, education is important. Riders, agents, all of us, we need to really see the bigger picture here and see where this sport has gone, where professional sport is going as well. And at some point, it needs to be a bit of a reckoning. Larry, let's talk about the race that sort of happened.
Okay.
Tom Pidcock was the big mover and shaker today. We saw, I suppose, something from him that we haven't seen before, certainly not of that level in this context, a Grand Tour dropping Jonas Vingegaard. On the other hand, it was a course, it was a route, there were climbs that suited Tom Pidcock, and we knew they would suit him. But how much do you think we should read into what we saw today from him?
I mean, I have to say, I was like really impressed. I wouldn't have expected him to be able to distance a guy like Vingegaard, even on a climb like today. But again, I do think it's probably about the climb that suited him the best in this Vuelta. So, you know, I would say, I would assume his weakness is still like the long climbs, you know, like Angleroo, things like that. So I guess we'll find out in a few days, but it was seriously impressive. And I mean, I think he's shown that he's ready to fight, you know?
Yeah, I think also he's vindicated, Larry. There were a lot of people sort of turning their nose up or raising eyebrows at him going for GC, and they thought that it was a bit of a vain pursuit. But I think that it's a question in his mind that he has to answer before he moves on to other things and another way of riding. I don't think he's had an emphatic answer thus far in his career that he's not suited to riding GC. So I think he's done the right thing. I mean, you can hardly, after today, thus far in the race, I don't think you can really quibble with that.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think I did, you know, I don't know if it was an interview or what that I read or heard yesterday. And, you know, he was talking about, or it might have even been you, talking about his preparation for the Giro and just how it was not ideal, you know, doing all the classics, everything like that. So he was tired by the time he got to the Giro, which is probably true. You know, I mean, especially being the, what would you say, talisman of his team, you know, the big leader, the guy, you know, he has to be everywhere and he has to perform everywhere. And, you know, that's what they signed him for. So, you know, I'd say next year they're going to have, you know, quite a solid supporting staff. But, you know, I'd say this year he was really the big name and the big guy who had to deliver all the results. So he had to be everywhere. And I think, yeah, by the time he got to the Giro, he was probably tired. And, you know, I think going into the Vuelta, he didn't have like some obscene race program because there aren't that many races in July if you're not doing the Tour de France. So I think he was able to prepare the way he wanted for this Vuelta. And maybe it's the first time he's been able to really, really do that for a Grand Tour. So I have to say, yeah, I mean, he definitely delivered today and it was impressive.
Mm. One other thing on the race, Larry, I suggested yesterday that UAE Team Emirates, they needed to start raising the stress levels of Visma Lisa bike. And I even suggested they do that by utilizing their number one agent of chaos, a man who can create chaos in an empty phone box, Marc Soler. Marc Soler was off the front for a lot of today's stage. Of course, he won a stage in Bilbao in 2022. However, it wasn't very effective. It probably wasn't the best use of his resources, his energies. And ultimately, if that's what it was, an attempt to unsettle or tire Visma Lisa bike, it didn't work, did it?
No. I mean, you know, and then we saw later on that they tried to accelerate into the bottom of the climb, but it almost looked like they were just doing a lead out for Vingegaard rather than for Almeida. So, you know, I mean, they tried, but yeah, it's hard, especially with such a strong Visma team. You know, it's almost like when you try to do something like that, you're almost doing their job for them. So, yeah, I don't think it's a simple nut to crack.
Larry, just while we've been recording, I don't think we've got the statement from the results from the Vuelta organization yet. I don't believe we have, but we have had a statement from Visma Lisa Bike CEO Richard Plugger. He said, "It's very unfortunate that such a decision is necessary to guarantee the safety of the riders. Everyone has the right to protest, but it should never put the others in danger. As a team, we do our job by giving our best every day and fighting for victory. We expect the police and the race organization to do their job in keeping the riders safe and ensuring a fair race. We once again urge all spectators to do everything possible to keep our riders safe." Nothing sort of eyebrow raising there, I wouldn't suggest. Larry, in part three, we're going to move the Encuentro del Día. We're going to have that. Well, no, we'll have it now. We'll have it now, Larry. Just to conclude part two, because that's traditionally what we do. The theme of the meetings of the day this week, I have decided sort of after the fact, because we had one yesterday with a Vuelta, and in fact, a Grand Tour debutant. Yesterday it was Johannes Stauner-Mittet, the Norwegian rider. And today I thought we'd have another one, a gentleman by the name of Liam Slok, who rides for Lotto. He is also riding his first Grand Tour. I spoke to him in Bilbao this morning. Here is today's Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day. Well, Liam, I'm interviewing this week people who are doing their first Grand Tour, but with you, I wanted to start with your name, which I know comes from your mother's affection for Liam Neeson. Is that right?
Yes, it's indeed right. She was a great fan of him, so that's why I'm named Liam.
When did you learn this, and what do you think of it?
I was quite old, actually. I think I was maybe 14, 15, I think, when I knew it.
And have you done a deep dive into the work of Liam Neeson since then, watched all his films?
Well, not particularly, but I've seen movies of him, of course, and I like the movies. So, yeah, it's nice to be named after him.
Okay, so as I said, this is your first Grand Tour. It seems to be going well. I mean, you've had two very long breakaways, but how would you say it's going?
Yeah, actually quite good. I'm not feeling extremely tired, so that's already a good sign. But the second week is really hard, so I need to survive this week because I don't think there are much chances for me. Maybe on Sunday there is a chance to get in the break, but it's a really hard start. So I'm just enjoying myself, and also the breaks was quite nice. And being on the podium one time for the combativity is a nice week already. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the stages.
Tell me a bit about the decision to send you here. Was it something that the team had been talking to you about for a long time? Because I think this is your third year with Lotto, but your first Grand Tour. So, tell me about how it came to pass.
Last year I already wanted to go to the Vuelta, but then the selection was already made and I was not on super high level. So in the winter we talked about it for going to the Vuelta this year. And then, the selection was quite made early, I think, for me, and I'm happy to be here.
And you're riding here with Elia Viviani. There's a photo on your Instagram of you with Elia Viviani when you were much younger, I think in 2018. Tell me about that.
It was on the sixth day of Ghent. I was there with a friend to watch, and Elia was competing there with, I think, Elio Kees that year, and they won also that year. But I took a photo with him, posted it on Instagram, and now it's a story.
He's seen it, I presume.
I've shown him. He didn't see it before, so I shown it when I heard about it. I was still on my Instagram because I didn't know anymore. And then I show him, and then he didn't really remember, of course, because he takes so much pictures.
A few things, other things that I've been told about your story, backstory. You were a footballer, is that right? We're in the San Mamés. We're outside the San Mamés Stadium at the moment. You were a decent footballer.
Oh, I'm not decent. I was still young when I was doing it. I was eight, I think. I played for Lokeren, and there was a team in first division back then in Belgium. But I wasn't that great. I was a keeper, and I like cycling more.
Next thing, you had Lyme disease at one point in the last few years.
I think it was 2022, but we are not certain it was Lyme. It was a difficult period. We diagnosed it, but I had never seen somewhere I had been bitten or something. So we still not know until now if it really was Lyme or just maybe extreme chronic tiredness.
One other thing, your dream is to win Paris-Roubaix?
For sure.
When's it going to happen? Give me a year.
Hopefully next year, but we will see. If I'm close one time, it's okay. Last year I was 20th. It was already a very nice experience, but I want to get close, but it's not easy.
Last couple of things. You say on the team website you would like to be a turtle if you were an animal because they have a long and peaceful life. We'll gloss over that, but the one I did not want to ask you about was you say you're afraid of heights. Has this ever affected you in a race? Because occasionally in a bike race you can be on, on a mountain pass, over an edge, and it could affect you.
No, never in a race, because then I'm on the ground. It's only when I would be standing on the stadium, for example, I would be scared. But now on a mountaintop, I'm feeling the ground still, and then it's okay.
Maybe in the next few days, maybe on the Angliru. Well, thanks a lot, Liam.
Thank you.
So, Larry, that was Liam Slock, who is afraid of heights and would like to be, or wishes he was a turtle, because turtles have peaceful lives. Even
speaking of turtles, I found a few turtles on my ride the other day.
Oh, did
actually.
You?
But that's another story.
Oh, did you? Larry, fear of heights. Have you ever come across a rider who's been troubled by that in the peloton? Because I said to Liam, but he's suggested it wasn't a problem on the bike. But there are. I can think of a few. I mean, I don't particularly suffer from vertigo, but I can think of a few mountain passes in Europe where you might.
you might get a little bit
queasy. I mean, if you looked over the edge, I could imagine you would be scared sometimes. But now I can't say that I have, at least I'm sure maybe I've known some guys who are scared of heights, but not in the sense that it affects their cycling. Mm.
Larry, we're going to talk now about tomorrow's stage, or in just a second. Before I forget, though, because I probably will forget, I don't think you can say much about this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Any news on next year? Not yet.
Not yet. Hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon. I can feel it in my waters. I've got a sense it might be good news, but will be revealed.
Cool, yeah. Let's hope.
All will be revealed soon. It is time, though, to talk about tomorrow's stage and briefly, I think, about yesterday's dinner.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So, Larry, we have got tomorrow a stage, a short stage of 144 kilometers from Laredo. I think we're in Cantabria already tomorrow, and we're finishing in Los Corrales de Buelna. We have two climbs. There's a second category climb, the Puerta de Alisas, after 41 kilometers, and after 122 kilometers, so that's 22 kilometers from the finish line, we have the summit of the Collada de Brenes, which is, I have the stats here somewhere, 7 kilometers at 7.9%. There are a couple of nasty kilometers, sort of 10%, 9%. Larry, it reminds me of stages we've seen in the Vuelta before. I mentioned Marc Soler earlier. Reminds me a bit of the stage you won a couple of years ago, Lecumberri, in the Basque Country as well. He's had a bit of a habit of that. I feel that he's won a couple of Vuelta stages where there's been a pretty hard climb, about 20 kilometers from the finish, gone down the descent and won on his own. But yeah, interesting, Larry. I wondered whether Q36.5, after what we saw today, whether they might see tomorrow as an opportunity to commit in the way they've committed on a few days at this Vuelta. So seven kilometer climb, 20k from the finish. What do you think, Larry?
I mean, I think it's possible. I wouldn't rule it out, you know. I mean, I would say they're going to go all in every chance they get to win a stage now in this Vuelta, because Pidcock shows that he has the legs to do so. But the only difficult thing is 20k to go is still a long way, and then you're likely to be in a big group, relatively big group, you know, or at least a few guys, and then, you know, he'll most likely be isolated after the climb. So, you know, I think it probably depends on how the race plays out leading up to that. You know, maybe they'll say, okay, if we can get only a small breakaway to go, then we'll control it. But if it's too hard to control and there's a big breakaway, then maybe they just say, you know, not going to happen. So, but they've definitely showed they're not scared to take the race on and ride for Pidcock when it's a good day for him. So, yeah, wouldn't surprise me, but I feel like when there's a final like that, it kind of screams breakaway.
We shall see, Larry. We shall see. Also reminds me a bit the stage tomorrow of one of the stages won by your current teammate. It wasn't your teammate then, Storachar at the Vuelta in Andalucía, what was the name of the place? Something de la Victoria, where Primoz Roglic attacked. It was the no risk, no glory stage where he attacked and then crashed. And in typical sort of, well, we had a bit of Landismo today. Primoz Roglic has treated us to various moments like that in the past, sort of, no risk, no glory kind of moves. And it reminds me a little bit of that stage. But we'll see what happens tomorrow, Larry, and whether indeed there are any footnotes, postscripts to all of the chaos and controversy we've seen today. But that concludes the episode. And I think it concludes, Larry, your time with us on this Vuelta a España. It's been short, but I've enjoyed it nonetheless. And, good luck in the next races you're doing. I think you are racing in a few days.
Yeah, I raced Maryland Cycling Classic on Saturday, so it should be nice. Excellent. First time racing in the US for a long time, so will be cool.
Excellent. Well, good luck with that, Larry, and do check in to tell us what is happening next year just as soon as you can. On that note,
will do.
Goodbye.
Thanks. Have a good one.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.